This is Radio Skid Row On Demand.
We have with us Mayor of Marrickville, Joe Halen.
Welcome to the program, Mr. Manu Tari. Kia ora, morena, Manu.
The CEO, Make-A-Wish, Gerard Menzies.
Radio Skid Row On Demand.
Radio Skid Row, 88.9 FM.
Well, I remember when I was young, the world had just begun and I was happy.
Hi, I'm Jeff Furlow and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM. The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is a weekly program for older Australians where we talk about ageing well. And every week, we'll talk about the issues that affect us as we age, right here and right now.
It happens every day.
Later in today's episode, we will be talking to Anton Enos, the SBS newsreader, about his formative cultural experiences in a segment called Nostalgia Town. Nostalgia Town is a weekly segment where we hear a well-known older Australian talk about their formative cultural experiences. Anton also speaks about his recent successful battle with bowel cancer. In later episodes, we'll hear from Australian comedian and author Gene Kitson, Radio Skid Row's own elder, Lex Marinos, who everybody remembers from Kingswood Country in the early days of ABC's 2JJ, and soon we'll also be hearing from Linda Burney, MP. And after that, we'll be speaking with Diane Eckert later in the episode, Vice President Education of Sydney U3A, about the Sydney University of the Third Age. But first things first, today we are going to discuss sex, relationships and ageing with an expert and then my two studio guests who will chew the fat with me on the punters panel. Our guest on Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century today is Bettina Arndt. Bettina Arndt trained as a psychologist before becoming well known as one of Australia's first sex therapists. She then had a long career as a social commentator, mainly on gender issues, and is now making YouTube videos about demonisation of men. Her new book, Hashtag Men Too, will be published in December. Good morning, Bettina. How are you today?
Very good, Jeff.
We're talking about sex and relationships as you age, but doesn't sex come to a sudden end as you age?
No, of course not. There was a famous author called Alex Comfort, back in the 1960s, I think it was, wrote a book called The Joy of Sex. And he said, the things that stop you from enjoying sex in old age are the same things that stop you from riding a bicycle. Bad health, thinking it's silly, and no bicycle. And I think that sort of sums it up. Because there are a lot of things that have changed since the 1960s to make it easier, so all of those particular issues become easier for people. I mean, the bad health issue was a really significant one, particularly, I think, back to the 1970s, for instance, when I was first working as a sex therapist. And we had a major problem then with older men having trouble with erections and no solution for them. We thought it was all in their heads, and it turned out it was all in their bodies, because we've discovered a huge amount since then about what happens to this wonderful erectile mechanism as men get older. And now we have the solutions to fix that. And it's just been a revolution for men. And similarly for women, I think there's a lot we've learned about helping, keeping women's bodies functioning well and supplying them with the hormones they need to keep, you know, everything well lubricated down there. And so there are a whole lot of health issues we've sorted out, which is a good start. And then the second thing about thinking it's silly, I mean, one of the reasons sex came to an end was an assumption that older people didn't have sex. And I think that's changed dramatically, that most people realise you can go on having sex all your life if you want to. But we still have a problem with the bicycle problem, and I think that's probably the major one for most people. You have to, I mean, obviously you can have sex on your own, but when it comes to having sex with a partner, sadly a lot of people don't have partners through to old age, or have a partner who isn't interested in sex anymore. To me, those are the really biggest issues preventing people from enjoying sex right through to, you know, their final years.
So there's mismatched desire, and there are people who are becoming single again later in their own lives.
And but that's changed enormously too. I mean, that's I spent 5 years as an online dating coach, and I was very excited when I heard about online dating, which has been around for over a decade now, and that's revolutionized the possibilities of new relationships for older people. I mean, once when you were single, you were widowed or you were divorced in your 50s, 60s, 70s, it was very difficult for people to meet people outside their immediate social circle, and that was often pretty limited. They often had mainly couple friends, and you were stuck with the people who were around at the time. Whereas now there's this opportunity for people of all ages to use online dating, and that's how most people are meeting new partners. I met my partner online after many years of online dating, and that was 4 years ago now, and he lives right up the Central Coast, and we would never in a million years have met in normal life, so it can work very well.
It's a new way of doing the same old thing.
Yeah, a very new way, and it's very confronting for many people. I don't do online dating any coaching anymore. People, a lot of people find it very confronting to start doing it. But once you get used to it, it's an extraordinary opportunity to meet a whole range of people. And maybe you only end up with a nice warm hand to hold in the movie theatre or someone to have coffee with or whatever. But a lot of people are meeting new partners throughout their lives through online dating.
And people do want to couple up even as they get older. So how important are intimate relationships as we age?
Particularly important in a way for men. I mean, it's important for men and women, but women tend to be better connected socially. I mean, women tend to have a stronger friendship network and often, for various reasons, are more intertwined with their families, their grown-up families, than men are. I mean, I've worked in recent years working a lot with men and advocating for men, and it really worries me how lonely a lot of men are. The highest suicide rate in Australia is elderly men. I think men can very easily get extraordinarily socially isolated once they retire and lose their work networks. And that's a major problem. And my experience with the dating coaching was always men tend to be much less content on their own than women are. Men would grizzle to me saying, you know, I'm supposed to be the buyer's market here. I mean, certainly the numbers are in favour of older men because there's a real disparity in numbers of available single men to women. I mean, many more women than men. And yet the men would say to me, well, why are women still so fussy? You know, I'm a perfectly decent bloke. Why are they interested in me? You know, of course, sometimes they were, but women tend to have more contented lives as single people than men do. And many men are very keen to replace the partner they've lost, whether through divorce or widowhood. And unless it's really enhancing their lives, they won't leap into a new permanent relationship.
I gather that there is a lot of research that shows that single men, particularly older men, do not fare as well as single older women.
That's right. So it's all sorts of things like creating a home. You know, we still have a very traditional lives, particularly, I suppose, in the older generations, where usually it's the woman who creates the nest, turning it into something beyond just a place where you can live, to somewhere which is really comfortable and nice place to be. And it's extraordinary how many men I've met in my life who are single men who don't put the effort into creating a comfortable home and don't really know how to go about doing that. Some do, and some are brilliant at it. And there are plenty of men who live very happy lives on their own, but there are an awful lot who aren't. And it's also the issue of not having enough to do. I mean, the women often would complain to me about meeting men who wanted them to entertain them and men who didn't have enough in their lives other than hitting little white balls into holes. When men who retire and then all they've got is golf or whatever it is. And very often, for complex reasons, I mean, women's lives tend to be so different from men's, and many women, of course, have children and then come back into the workforce. So they have a new burst of enthusiasm about their careers, and whereas men have often been stuck in the same careers for an awfully long time, and women are much more likely to get involved in other social activities. I've done a lot of research on this over the years, and so the women have their book clubs and their knitting clubs and their whatever it is, and men very often don't have nearly as much opportunity for social interaction. I mean, one of the things that helping with that, of course, is the men's shed movement, which I've always been very enthusiastic about, giving men an opportunity to connect together and have special time with other men, which gives them a chance to talk about things that they don't want to talk about in front of women.
There's a place, do you suppose, for continuing the idea of a secret women's business and secret men's business?
Oh, of course there is. And the Dead Shed was supposed to be about secret men's business, and in the sense that it's understood that some men will have conversations with other men more easily when there aren't women around. And I think that applies to women too. There are women who want to go to a gym session where there aren't men looking at them, where they feel maybe they're overweight, maybe they're not comfortable doing exercise in front of men. I mean, there are reasons why women would want to do some things on their own and why men should too.
I'm Susan Ryan, and I was Australia's first age discrimination commissioner. You're listening to The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century. Get connected, stay connected.
Older people do have problems that they have to overcome forming new relationships. And
obviously they do, and I don't think they're particularly different from problems faced by anybody forming new relationships. You feel the same way putting yourself forward as a man or a woman and asking someone to go out with you as you did when you were 20, you know, even if you are 60. But what's different is interesting, people who've been married for 30, 40 years and then go back out there looking for a new partner, the whole dating world is very different. Online dating, of course, is extremely different from the business at maybe 40 years ago, waiting for someone to ask you out on a date. One of the things I used to have to teach women is that women have to take the initiative these days. They can't wait to be asked. In fact, there are websites, particular dating sites, which require women to always make the first move, which I think is a really good idea. But there are other sites where if women aren't in there approaching men, they won't do very well at all. They can't just wait for the men to be interested in them, and particularly if they're interested in the more eligible men. And so, you know, all those sorts of rules have changed a lot. And, of course, the issue of sex, which is an interesting one, of the assumptions about how you progress to a sexual relationship have changed dramatically. And a lot of women in particular find that difficult. I mean, there's the joke about online dating that around the third or fourth date, either it progresses to an intimate relationship or it's not going anywhere. It's a really accelerated process. And I worked with lots of women who get very offended at the idea. You know, someone might give you a kiss on the end of a first date when you've only just met. And all of that they find very confronting, let alone deciding whether they're wanting to go to bed with this man after a few dates. You don't have to do that. I've dealt with people and I've worked with clients who went out with a man for a year, one in particular, before they decided to get intimate, and it's quite possible to do that. But given that a lot of other people are tending to move pretty quickly into a more intimate relationship, there's a lot of pressure on you in that situation.
So you do get older, you are more experienced, but that doesn't mean that starting to date again isn't a difficult and a scary thing.
Yeah, you can be more experienced with one person. You know, you can have had a 30-year relationship with one person, and it's a huge shock to go out and have to start again meeting new people. But it's really confronting for older men and women. I mean, women often are very nervous about the horrifying thought of taking off your clothes for someone you don't know. And I remember I certainly went through my own nervousness around that issue. You think he's going to run screaming from the room when he takes one look at you. And you know, I've talked to women who endlessly clutched, you know, towels and sheets around their necks and hid themselves. And, you know, this self-consciousness about our bodies is a major issue, particularly for women. And I suppose the really obvious one for men is the erection problem. If you're ever going to have trouble with erections, it's going to be with a new woman, you know, because you're going to be anxious and you may not have been in that situation for a long time, so you don't really know how your equipment's going to stand up. And I think that makes it particularly difficult for men. I once talked to a lovely man who sort of nailed this whole problem. He'd been online dating for a long time, and he had what he called a capricious penis. It didn't always behave. It was rather unpredictable. And he was really upfront with the women, and he would say, you know, he'd been dating them for a bit, and they felt the relationship was going to be intimate. He'd say, look, I have this issue. This is how my body tends to behave when I'm with someone new. But he said, I'm a really good lover and I know how to please you. So don't worry, if it doesn't work out in terms of me getting erections, I'll look after you. And he hardly ever had a knockback in that situation. He found that anyone who was thinking of getting intimate with him would usually be really comfortable, particularly because he'd been prepared to talk about it. And one of the issues we all have is our nervousness of having proper conversations around sex. I've always said to men and women, don't guess, don't feel, you know, I wonder if I invite him for coffee, he might think I want to have sex with him. You talk about things like that. And you say, look, it'd be great after the movies if you wanted to come and have coffee, but I'm not ready to leap into bed with you. You can have those sorts of conversations, and it makes it easier for men and women if you do.
So having the conversation is a very important part of the whole process of
forming a relationship. Yeah, a lot of us just aren't used to having those conversations. I mean, I remember in my own case, when my first relationship after a long marriage, when I was single, and I was very nervous about that and so on, and this lovely man was just being very careful and comfortable with me. And eventually we were on a long walk, and I joked to him and said, I'm going to need the WD-40. It's so long since I've had sex. And he said, never, don't worry, I'm a very patient man. And it was such a good answer.
A very good answer. And that goes back to what the author of The Joy of Sex said about your health.
Yeah.
Being one of the big three,
you
did mention that the second one is that you would fear that you were making a fool of yourself.
Yeah.
And Steve Biddulph, in something that you sent me to read, mentioned that most men are still basically ashamed of their sexual feelings.
Well, most men and women are nervous around this whole issue. And the whole business of when you get sexual consent, and are you really supposed to say to a woman, can I kiss you, can I touch you, can I stroke your breast? All of that applies, presumably, to the 80-year-olds as well as to the 20-year-olds, and particularly the older generation of women. And there are many women I know who wouldn't be remotely interested in a man who constantly asks for permission every inch of the way. They'd feel he was a total nerd. Still, I mean, that many women still expect the man to seduce them. So what do you do with that?
So we still have expectations. We still carry our baggage, our values.
And you want, you know, many women want a man who acts as if he knows what he's doing. And obviously, experienced man can read body signals and can know if he's stroking your neck, whether you're appreciating it or not, or whether you're trying to push away from him.
Well, we have our vulnerabilities as we age, but what are our strengths as we age and we try and form new relationships and intimate relationships?
The wonderful thing is you know, you get over yourself. I mean, the fact is you tend not to take life as seriously. I think most of us, luckily, acquire some confidence along the way and don't sweat the small stuff nearly as much. And if we can get over our initial self-consciousness, which is understandable, then, you know, we're in a much better position to really appreciate the joys of relationships, the joys of sex, because we know how precious it is. We've lived long lives. We've had a lot of times where we've felt very lonely in a marital bed or whatever it is. And I think to appreciate the good things, appreciate even a very wrinkled hand stroking your back can be a wonderful thing.
So even though we might have had a vigorous sex life as younger people, it still can be enriching.
Oh, absolutely. And from a women's point of view, those of us who've had a good sex life are in a position to... we know our bodies, we know what we like, we often have the confidence to tell the man how to make love to us properly. I mean, that life experience can be invaluable when it comes to starting new relationships. And it applies to sex, but also applies, hopefully, to conducting civilized, loving relationships where we know how to deal with conflict and we don't bottle things up and we can talk about the hard stuff. And many of us have had relationships that have failed along the way, and hopefully we've learned something from them as well.
Well, Bettina, what are the key messages you want to send to older Australians about sexuality and relationships as they age?
Oh, I think my main message, as is always my main message, is optimism, is to look forward to pleasure and the extraordinary pleasure of rediscovering love, rediscovering sexual relationships when you're very much older, and perhaps at a time when you didn't think it could ever happen to you again. Falling in love again is the most extraordinary thing, and it can happen to any of us. Lightning can strike 2, 3, 4, 5 times in our lives if we're very lucky.
Do you think that ageing can be fun?
Oh, I think ageing has huge advantages. I mean, obviously the end point is rather difficult to contemplate, but there are real advantages to the process, as well as obviously downsides. It's always disconcerting to look in the mirror and think, who's that old woman?
Yes, it's a bit confronting getting out of the shower and seeing how things have all gone south.
Yeah, and let alone showing it to someone else. You can get through that, let me tell you.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
And that was Bettina Arndt speaking to me recently on Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century about sexuality and relationships as we age. And now it's time for the Punters Panel, where we speak with local older people about the issue of the day. And my studio guests today are the wonderful Beverly Baker, Chair of Older Women's Network New South Wales, and my good friend Lorne Hyde, who is aged somewhere between 55 and 80. And I want to ask you two, after having listened to our good friend Bettina, doesn't sex just end when you hit 65?
No. Who would want it to anyway? It changes, certainly changes. I remember of a very old joke, what are the three stages of sexual? Of sex is tri-weekly, spelt tri with an I, tri-weekly, which is tri-weekly, yep. And the other is tri-weekly, which is weekly with a double E, with an A. So it's tri-weekly, tri-weekly, tri-weekly.
Yes,
and I think that's probably true. As you age, things don't necessarily work as well, but your emotions, your feelings, those things remain intact.
And you still have desire?
Absolutely.
And that's great news. Such a relief. What about you?
Absolutely gets better as you get older. I don't know, you've ever heard the saying, older the violin, sweeter the music, or older the buck, stiffer the horn. You know, it's got to be fun. It's not quick. It's not, let's get it over with. It's not that sudden release because I got to have it. It's this wonderful relationship. It's this wonderful sense of togetherness. It's this, it's not rushed, you know what I mean? You can do it at your own pace and you can enjoy what you're doing. You can talk about it and you explore each other. It's not like it used to be when I was a kid. It's much better.
It's not as urgent.
Not as urgent.
It's more companionable. It's a deeper sharing. I think.
And you don't even have to get to the same end result, really. Some people say, well, let's go and have a cup of coffee and then come back and start again.
Yeah. Because things change. I mean, Bettina was right. You know, the things of ageing impact across your life. And I laugh when I think that you used to moan in ecstasy, now you moan in agony. But it's still moaning, but it's a change. For women of my age group, we, and for men as well, we've grown through an age where sex was a forbidden subject to where it's in your face. Mm-hmm. And that causes confusion and confliction and worrying about whether or not and how you fit, because as young people, we were like, we'll be considered not nice. To now, it's like, what are they doing in public? You know, it's a complete change of that approach. And for older people, it's sometimes a bit difficult to come to grips with that change in society and the society's expectations. People honestly do believe that old people really don't do or know or think or feel anything. We're just there.
Yeah, I have to say, though, that having been in a long-term relationship where over a period of time sex decreased, then you became companions, and then that relationship ended, and I started a new relationship, I have to say, the lust is there, the sex is just like it was, in my 30s or 40s, and that continues to go on. And maybe there is a seven-year itch. Maybe it'll start dwaning a bit after a few years. But I think we have the capacity to regenerate ourselves with a new relationship and just be as excited as we were when we were in our 20s.
And that is happening to people as they age, is that they sometimes find that their long-term relationships have ended, their partners have, for one reason or another, moved on, and they find themselves alone. Tell me about forming new relationships as you're aging.
Well, I guess for me it's been a bit like the old school, although, you know, I met friends through friends. Although online dating was a bit, I tried that, it was a bit fun. You know, the casual sex was great, but really you never had much going with the person. It was just like, well, we're going to have a fuck tonight, let's get it over and go, please. And because that's what you see, and the online image is never what you get, I might add. So But when you do find somebody, regardless of how you find them, it could be at the pub or it could be through friends, I mean, that new relationship development is really inspiring. And you do develop new skills, and not new skills, but new interests, I should say, whatever the other person brings to your relationship. So, yeah.
And as you get older, it's not, as I said, it's not so urgent. You're not thinking about having children and establishing this and getting your home sorted out and wherever, all these things. Those sorts of things tend to have been in your past. So the relationships you build are slightly different. They're not that urgency, that how are we going to, where are we going to have kids? What am I going to do for my next job? When am I going to go? Those sorts of things are part of your history. Yeah. And you bring all of that baggage with you to a new relationship. But a new relationship gives you the opportunity to get rid of the stuff about yourself you don't like and rebuild a person that you do like, that you don't have to be the mother from, you know, the naggy mum or the grumpy wife or the whatever you might have been because of your circumstances. You can reinvent yourself. You can be a different person. And that's so important for human beings.
And you know what? We do different things. Because we're at this age where we don't have to have a job, we don't have to rely too much on income, we can actually, we're very thrifty with our money, but we can go and do things, we can go to the parks, we can go to the theatre, we can go to the art gallery, we can take overseas trips together. And as you say, babe, we don't have to worry about bringing up the kids or the financial pressures on you or the mortgage. There's so much more.
Or contraception.
Or contraception.
Which is a plus.
Yes, that's right. But just, Fatina did mention physical problems in old age, and I do like to think that a lot of people as they get older are going to have lots of problems, and there are medications for their blood pressure, for their diabetes, for their heart disease, and no GP, or very few GPs, I would imagine, ever discuss that with people. And that's a very important thing for people to realise, that if you're impotent or, you know, if you're not lubricating very well, then it's really important that your doctor should actually bring this up with you, because it's something that they know about. And those physical medications are the ones that often stop you from having sex.
Well, I think that a four-letter word for sexual intercourse is not the one that leaks to everyone's mind. It's actually talk. Mm. And you talk. Intercourse is talk.
Yes.
And if you're with someone who is has a problem, is uncomfortable, maybe for some women sex is uncomfortable. Yeah. They don't have a good history or a good memory of it. If they are happy and relaxed enough to be able to talk, then together you can work things out. It's not a competition anymore. It's not, I mean, look at my conquest sheet. I've got all of these people. It's about that companionship, that partnership. And it might be that sex isn't the main driving force. Well, it's not the main driving force of your relationship. It's a bonus. The driving force of your relationship is companionship, shared experiences, having someone to do things with, not being lonely, having someone to appreciate you cooking a meal, things like that that make it a really deep and rich relationship. And sex flows out of that. Sex doesn't drive that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is men often think they have to be conquerors. And as a younger man, we don't talk about how many times we've had sex. And as an older man, you probably still think that that's what's important when you meet a woman. You know, can you do it? And Patina mentioned about the precocious penis.
Capricious penis.
Yeah, capricious. Yeah. So, you know, and that is true, you know. Performance anxiety is a very important thing. And whilst you think, oh, it's easy for a woman because all she has to do is take her clothes off and lay there, I mean, that's not the way it is. And certainly it's not like that for men. It's not coming up now. What the hell's going on?
I mean, we have as a society a whole body image thing.
Yeah.
We've got a whole raft of people who think sex is really about conquest and not about companionship. And you bring all of that with you to a new relationship. I mean, I'm so pleased I'm in a long-term relationship. The idea of me taking my clothes off in front of somebody I don't know that well, I'd be terrified, absolutely frightened, witless of going through that judgment.
Well, it's been a lovely, lovely chat that I've had with both of you. Thank you very much, my guests on the Punters panel, Lorne Hyde and Beverly Baker. I look forward to having you both on the show again sometime soon. For the segment of the show that we call Nostalgia Town, where we talk to well-known older Australians about the musical, the theatrical and the film experiences that helped make them the people they are today.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
My guest today is Anton Enos, the host of SBS World News on the special broadcasting service, born in South Africa, Anton.
Yes, indeed. Jeff, thank you very much for having me on your program. Yes, I'm a migrant Australian, and I've been living here for most of my adult life, I would say. Very happily, I might add. I've been welcomed here from day one, and I've been made to fit in exceedingly well, living a lovely life in Sydney.
Tell me about your formative cultural experiences. What was the important music to you as you were growing up?
I was quite influenced by my parents. They both loved music. They both loved to sing. They loved jazz. So we listened to a lot of varied music as I was growing up, but mainly the sort of classic jazz artists such as Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan. Della Reese was a great favorite of my parents and became a favorite of mine. Louis Armstrong, of course. So there was a lot of that kind of music wafting through the house during my childhood. My parents always loved to sing along. They loved throwing parties, and it would always end up at the piano. My mother would be playing, everyone would be singing. So there was quite a lot of music in my childhood. If you could sing, you just sing along, enjoy it. It was never whether you could do it very well or very badly. Everyone just had a go. And I think that kind of taught me a real love of music, not just for singing, which I still love to do today, but also just for listening to music, how to, you know, listen with an open mind and listen to things that you're maybe not used to listening to.
Was pop music ever an influence on you?
Well, I suppose pop music of the day. I can remember going to concerts as a youngster, Percy Sledge. Della Starr was a great performer from those days. The Hughes Corporation. You know, my parents were quite young at heart. Even as they got older, their attitude was quite young, and so they would be really into their music and into, they'd get up and dance at concerts and things like that. They were never, ever kind of middle-aged or aging in any sense of the word. They were always very, very young, outwardly young-looking. When I was a kid, we'd go to movies quite often. I did not grow up with televisions. You know, television came very late to South Africa. So you'd go to a matinee movie, or you would listen to things on the radio. We would listen as a family. We would actually sit together and listen to like a radio drama or a quiz show or a music variety show or something like that. But you'd actually sit down and listen to it like it was a performance. In those days, everything happened at a particular time, whether it was the news or a music program or whatever it is you were listening to or watching at the movies. And you had to be there for the start. Otherwise, you're just going to miss out. And things that my parents liked, I tended to like, because it was good stuff. You know, if you think of Ella Fitzgerald or Louis Armstrong, Sarah Vaughan, that was really good music. I didn't feel like I needed to rebel against that.
Tell me, Anton, can aging be fun?
My intention certainly is to enjoy it all the way through. You're not young and then middle-aged and then old. You have a kind of thread that goes through all of those ages. And make sure you enjoy things creatively and spiritually through, you know, the different years, the different eras you're going through. But make sure you're always enjoying it. Don't suddenly get to 55 or 60 and you're facing the prospect of retiring and then you think, oh, well, what am I going to do now? How am I going to fill my time? What I've done is set in place things that I've enjoyed throughout the decades of my adult life and then just continue to develop those things. And the music is one of those things. I like playing sports. I play a lot of tennis and I run, I swim, I do yoga and so on. So those are sort of constructive things to do. And then also in terms of cultural life, I do a lot of attending plays and music concerts, symphony, opera and so on. Try to structure our lives in such a way that every day is interesting in some way or another. Find stuff that you love and then develop those interests. Don't just kind of sit back and think, oh, what am I going to do today? Shall I listen to some music? No, no. Choose something, schedule it, enjoy it, and then find a way to replicate that enjoyment.
Anton, do you value your social connections?
Jeff, I have to say this. I'm not a very gregarious person that I have to have a big party or I have to have been crowds of people. I don't like loud situations. I don't like very raucous situations. I like small groups of people. my socializing will take place in the form of meeting a couple of friends for lunch, or through my book club, or through my tennis friends. So you know, lots of little things to do. I'm not one for going out in a big group and sort of having a huge night out or doing something where you've got to, you know, jump and shout and stuff like that. I'm a bit over that. I kind of like smaller, quieter things.
People have different ways of connecting. Some are much more intimate and small. Some people are party-ish and want to go out with big groups. But the important thing is that having social networks insulates you, protects you, strengthens you as you age.
We use the term community. I think that's a very important word. If I think about my local neighbourhood, I live in Redfern in Sydney, and I have lived there for a very long time. If I think of all the people that I meet in the course of a morning, I'd be out for a walk or out for a coffee or just in the park with the dog or something like that, there's a lot of that. People look out for one another, stop and say, how are you today? What's been going on? Or if you're out for a coffee, they'll stop and tell you what's been going on in their life. And that translates into situations where someone may be ill or someone may be struggling with something. Those same connections then step up and say, how can I help? What can we do to support you through this? And, you know, that sounds like a sort of airy-fairy idea, but it works very, very well in practice. I've seen it 2 decades living in Redfern now. I see that that actually works in an everyday sense. When people are struggling, you hear it through the grapevine, so-and-so is having a problem, they can't do this or they're struggling with that, and then somebody will have a resource to kind of help, even if it just means someone to talk to or someone can't get to the hospital because the husband can't drive them or something like that. There'll always be somebody there who can say, okay, well, I know somebody who can help you with that. I know somebody who can, you know, get you an appointment with the doctor or something. I really feel that is a really important thing, that people actually look out for each other. But I also do value quiet time.
A few years ago, Anton, you were diagnosed with bowel cancer. And a lot of our listeners will know about that because you were quite public about it. Do you want to talk at all about that? How are you going now?
I'm going very well at the moment, Jeff. I've been cancer-free for a few months now, so it's been a very good, 9 months or so. Yeah, it was a very challenging time. It took, from the time of the diagnosis to where I am now, has taken about 2 years. It was a bit complicated and so on, but it was detected early enough. I think that's the absolutely crucial part of this story, is that we were able to identify the problem early enough so that they could do something. You know, I think that's the message I push more strongly than anything else these days. You've got to arm yourself with information. So, you know, that the National Bowel Cancer Screening Program, I think that is absolutely the best place for people to start, just to kind of, you know, ascertain where they are with the health of their bowel. As you know, when you turn 50, you get this kit sent to you free of charge by the federal government. It's a stool sample test that you have to do and send back. Most of the time it'll come back clear, but occasionally there might be something that needs following up. So in my case, it came back clear when I was 50. The second time I did it, I was 55, and then there was a note that said, please see your GP about these results. It didn't say this is a problem or it's a crisis or anything like that. It just said, please see your GP about these results. I did delay for a while. I was, you know, being a typical middle-aged man, I was like, oh, it's nothing, you know, it's a waste of time. I couldn't be bothered, you know, we're going to go through all this effort and then it's going to come to nothing. But I'm very glad that I did have that conversation with the GP, because as it turns out, he said, we'll send you for colonoscopy, we just need to at least exclude something. And as it turns out, they found a very large tumor in my bowel that had been there for 7 or 8 years. So it was quite well established, and we needed to do something quite quickly. But without that test, I think it could have just gone horribly wrong. You know, once the cancer starts metastasizing, then you're in very dangerous territory. Obviously, the earlier you can get that diagnosis and find out that if there is a problem, find out what it is you can do, the better the outcome at the end.
Absolutely. So that's a bit of a reminder. When we get the bowel screening package in the post, take advantage of it. The earlier we pick these things up, the better, yeah, as you are testimony.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that that screening program saved my life. I had no symptoms, you know, and I had no family history of it. I was living a very healthy lifestyle. I've never been a smoker. I've spent my adult life running marathons. I've run over 50 marathons, ultra marathons. I'm a very healthy person, you know, very, very moderate drinker. I would never have guessed that there was a problem down there. If it wasn't for the screening program, I would never have known. Or, we might have waited until there were symptoms, and then it might have been too late. Then the cancer could have gone everywhere by then, and then the outcome would have been much more complicated, if not dire. So I really urge people, you know, if you get that kit in the mail, please do it. It takes 5 minutes to do. It really could save your life. At the moment, we have an uptake rate of about 2 in 5. You know, I reckon that is just, it's too low. You know, 2 out of 5 people actually return the kits and get the sample tested. We need to push that up. It's a free test. It takes 5 minutes and it could save your life.
Perhaps it's a little bit like a plebiscite. You get to vote.
Yes. That's one way of looking at it. The very real situation about this, though, is that it's such an individual thing. It's like you cannot possibly know if there's a problem down there unless you actually do some kind of test. And, you know, the stool sample test is the most simple. It's not the, you know, it's not the panacea. It at least will point to some problem if there is a problem, you know, and then it needs some following up. For most people, you won't need any following up. It just gives you the all clear to say, everything's fine, it's just within the normal range and so on. That's great. There's a small band of people who are going to need some kind of follow-up, and within that there'll be another small group who will need some kind of proper treatment if there's a cancer problem.
And as you say, it can save your life.
Absolutely. It's such a weird, counterintuitive thing that the 3 out of 5, 60% of people don't take the test. Even though it's free, it's sent to you in the mail, it's very easy to do it. And yet most people don't do it. And then I always ask people this. If I said to you, okay, you're going to do this 5-minute test. It's non-invasive. It's free. But it could save the life of your wife or your son or your brother or your mother. Would you do it? And of course the answer is yes. Of course you would do it. You know, it takes you no effort at all. Could save someone's life. But then the question is, why won't you do it for yourself? What's the difference? You know, why would you save somebody else's life with a small effort? And yet the same effort to save your own life, you go, oh, it's too much trouble. I don't have time. I don't want to be a burden on people. So my strong message to people is take that 5 minutes, do the test. It's going to give you just enormous benefits.
Thank you for talking to us about this, Anton. This is a healthy aging program, and looking after your bowel health is a part of your health as you age. Anton Enos, I would like to thank you very much for joining us today on The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century and for being our guest on Nostalgia Town. I'd like to take the opportunity now to ask you if you would like to nominate any song to go out on.
A song that I've been listening to now for maybe 40 years has been I'd Love from Beginning to End, and that is Janet Ian, who sings the song At 17. I absolutely love it.
Anton, we will go out on that song, and I want to thank you very much for joining us again today.
It's been my great pleasure, Jeff.
And that was Janice Ian with her 1975 hit song At 17 from Between the Lines. And before that, we heard from Anton Enos, who reminds us how important it is to do the poo test when we get it in the mail. And now, on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century, it's time for Out and About, where we find out about some of the things that older people can do in Sydney and in the Inner West. Our guest today on Out and About is Diane Eckert, who's the Vice President Education for Sydney U3A. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm delighted to be with you.
Diane, what is U3A Sydney and who is it aimed at?
U3A stands for the University of the Third Age. The Third Age is that period of your life immediately after full-time employment. Now, the U3A movement is a global movement that came about in 1973 in the Toulouse University of Social Science. The French government enacted legislation that required universities to provide more community education. So Sydney U3A is part of that global movement. The U3A movement has spread throughout the world. I need to say that the word university is not used in its common form. It's more or less used in its traditional form, and that was a group of people coming together to pursue learning for its own sake. It's a university outside the walls of a university, essentially.
And it's pretty much aimed at older people.
It is aimed at people who are no longer in the workforce. We have members who are aged from their 50s to well into their 90s.
Quite a range, all the way up to 90.
Into their 90s. Sydney U3A was established in 1988, and it's a not-for-profit, volunteer-based organisation. And as we just mentioned, our members are people in their third age, and we provide continuing education opportunity for those people.
And why do we need to have a project like U3A?
Well, we definitely need to have a project like U3A because, quite simply, the U3A provides social identity. U3A does not only facilitate lifelong learning at a low cost, it actually assists in keeping Australia's population healthy and active and creative. You know, the third age can sometimes be a very, very lonely period of life, especially if a partner has passed or children are moving away on their own life's journey. We play a vital role in keeping our members socially connected and integrated. And many of our members have developed enduring friendships and they're learning at the same time. Now, if we keep our minds occupied in learning new things, then it is generally accepted that the ageing process is slow. Research indicates that association between adult education and midlife cognitive ability are all positive. Our leaders and the people who deliver the lectures, their breadth and the depth of their knowledge base is absolutely incredible. We have got all sorts of courses. We go from history, language courses, sociology, psychology, philosophy, we've got bushwalking, we've got dance, we've got calligraphy, just something for everybody. Doesn't matter whether you're highbrow, doesn't matter whether you just want a social environment, U3A delivers that education.
And how do people feel about the courses that they attend?
We've been operating in Sydney for 31 years. Our membership is about 6,500. The feedback tells us that U3A not only facilitates lifelong learning at a low cost, it actually assists them to be healthy and active. And they really appreciate that. They have friendships, they have social identities, they're connected, and they learn, and they are not just sitting at home, they're not dependent. And our membership fees are only $65 a year. Now, members do not have to pay an extra course fee. They can attend any course in any area at no extra charge. If it's a drawing class or if it's a painting class, there may be a little extra fee for the equipment that they would use if they go, or say, on a coach tour to a historic house or something. Well, it'll be the cost of the coach and the membership. But when you can go every day to a course for $65, the people are just so appreciative of that, and that's why we need it.
And with a membership of about 6,500, I suppose that means that Sydney U3A is a success. What's next for Sydney U3A?
To spread the message and to grow our membership and to keep on excelling and to maintaining our sterling record as a continuous educator.
How can people find out more about Sydney U3A?
Well, they can visit our website, which is sydneyu3a.org. Our website has a copy of our course book. Members can join online or they can phone our Sydney Central office. The number there is 9267 9056, and they can chat to some of the people in the office or they can ask for an application form or a course book to be sent out to them.
Diane Eckert from Sydney U3A, thank you very much for joining us today on Out and About on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been lovely talking to you.
The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is produced in the studios of Radio Skid Row. You can hear this show again weekly on Thursdays at 3 p.m. or you can listen again online by going to www.radioskidrow.org, and you'll find a link in the SoundCloud box to the right. This production was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more by going to cbf.org.au. This show was produced with the assistance of Lex Marinos and Raul Hernandez. I'm your host, Jeff Warlow, and I hope you can join us again next week.